Almost 25% of the world's calories come from wheat in bread, pasta, cereal, and in grain-fed beef. And it's an important cash crop for farmers around the world, but one that's susceptible to drought, infestation, and blight. Wheat was the life's work of Bent Skovmand, a Danish-born plant scientist who sought to save and protect wheat varieties in seed banks. Susan Dworkin tells his story and explains the importance of seed diversity in The Viking in the Wheat Field. A scientist struggled to preserve the world's harvest, which is published by Walker & Company. I'm very pleased that it has brought Susan Dworkin to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You begin your book talking about spores, an outbreak of stem rust in Africa in 1998. Where did that outbreak start, and how extensive was it?
It started in Uganda in 1998. Rust is a terrible disease of wheat that takes on many forms and has many races. And there wasn't a big rust outbreak in the world of wheat growing for a long time because there were a lot of genes that scientists managed to put into the wheat to protect the wheat. And then suddenly, boom, 2005, a scientist looking at a field in Uganda saw these disgusting-looking pox-like sores on the wheat, and lo and behold, a new race of stem rust was born. They called it UG99 for Uganda 99.
Because this wheat was supposed to be resistant
to rust. Right. It was supposed to be resistant, and suddenly all the genes that they had so laboriously built into these different strains of wheat were useless in protecting the wheat.
But this has, we've had other major outbreaks, haven't we?
Yes, but not for a while. This was a new race of stem rust. And the thing about rust is that it blows on the wind. And if there's a hurricane or a big storm, it can be carried across borders very, very swiftly.
So a rust outbreak in Uganda can actually affect wheat production in Kansas?
Yes, sir. Yes. What this one has done is it moved into the Arabian Peninsula, it moved across Africa, into Kenya. It's terrible devastation in Kenya from rust. And then it moved across the Red Sea into Yemen, up the Arabian Peninsula, it got into Iran, and now it's on its way to India.
Is there irony in that? Didn't wheat originate in the Fertile Crescent?
Yes, it did. It did. But I don't know how much irony there is. The truth is that wheat has always been susceptible to various diseases, and this particular disease is something that requires everybody in the world who's working on wheat to work together to stop.
Is this the same sort of thing that we saw with the potato famine in Ireland, and we've seen in with corn and some other crops, that we have one kind of wheat, and then if something comes along that can attack it, we are in serious trouble?
Yes, I understand what you mean, but this is not quite
a... This is not a monoculture
this
problem?
This is not a monoculture problem because the rust keeps mutating.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps changing. The minute you put up a different breed of wheat, the rust finds a way to breed itself to attack that particular wheat.
So if we went back to heirloom seeds, we would still face the same problem?
Yes. Every crop of wheat over the history of the grain has been eventually attacked by rust. So it's this like ongoing struggle between the scientific community to build in resistance in the next crop and the disease that then responds. It's like a big race between the disease and the people who are fighting.
And these spores just live off of wheat?
Yes. There's rust that affects sorghum. There's rust that affects other kinds of grain, but it doesn't. There's no rust that affects rice. And they're looking very hard for genes in rice that might be brought into the wheat genome, which might protect the wheat.
So you're not one of those people who is critical of genetic engineering?
You know, since I wrote this book and I spent all this time with Dr. Skovmand, I am less so. I was more so at the beginning. But I've been convinced that there's a lot of utility in some of these genetic modifications.
So let's talk about Bent Skovmand, the man who this book is mostly about. What attracted him to work in plant science in the first place?
Bent Skovmand was a Danish boy who grew up, his father was a minister, and he grew up in Jutland near Odense, and he grew up in a whole area that was full of farms and always worked on farms. He and his brother, his sister, they always worked on the farms. And they did a lot of grunt physical labor. And I don't know whether he would have become a great plant scientist if he'd stayed in Denmark, but he didn't stay in Denmark. He got a scholarship. He came to the University of Minnesota, and he went to work for a family in Minnesota called the Lee family, and they welcomed him as a kind of surrogate son. And he loved America. He loved his brother would say, the freedom, the largeness, the opportunity of America.
He also came at a time when the Green Revolution had been launched by people like Dr. Norman Borlaug.
Particularly by Dr. Norman Borlaug, so that he was in the aura and the ambiance of Borlaug and a guy named Edwin Charles Stakeman at the University of Minnesota, which is kind of the epicenter of rust fighting in this country, in fact, in the world.
He worked for an organization called CIMMYT, C-I-M-M-Y-T. Yeah. What kind of organization is that?
The CIMMYT is part, CIMMYT stands for the International Center for the Improvement of Maize, which is corn and wheat. And we know it by its Spanish acronym, CIMMYT. It's one of many, I think there are 15, and 11 of them are big plant collections. Parts of the CG system, the system of international agricultural research centers that goes around the world. And one is the Rice Center called Erie in Los Baños in the Philippines. One is in Colombia for tropical agriculture. One is in India for subtropical agriculture. There are big centers all around the world, and the one for maize and wheat is in Mexico, and that's where Borlaug worked.
My guest is Susan Dworkin, whose latest book is The Viking in the Wheat Field, A Scientist's Struggle to Preserve the World's Harvest. As I said earlier, wheat originated in the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia. How different is wheat today from the original grain?
It's very different. It's very different. Part of this book, which I try to devote to the history of the genetic resources movement, and one of the people who was a predecessor, an ideological predecessor of Skovmund, who was the world's most important seed banker one time, was a guy named Jack Harlan, and he described how the ancient farmer selected various grains to get the kind of wheat that we want, as opposed to the kind of wheat that nature wants. And each trait that you select for makes it a little bit easier to harvest it and to feed people with it.
Are some of the older heirloom varieties still around?
Yeah.
Are they being collected?
They are. People like Skovmund spent years trying to find them and hunt them down in places like Tibet and places like Turkey, spent years in Turkey. But the truth is that there are very few places where the ancient varieties are kept. One of them is in Israel. I was in Israel in a place called the Arbel, and it's like being in the Book of Ruth. It's the most extraordinary thing. It's very different.
One botanist and plant explorer was Nikolai Vavilov. What did he do?
Nikolai Vavilov was a Russian who was, in the 20s and 30s, the greatest botanist and plant explorer in the world. I think they modeled Indiana Jones on him because he had all these adventures with snakes and crocodiles. Vavilov created a theory, which is a really revolutionary theory, that each major crop had a center of origin, and that in that center of origin, all the relations and the weeds and the enemies and the bugs and the animals and all the environmental setups that would make that crop viable were all there. And if you kept the centers of origin clear, you could always find the genetic heritage of the crop.
We saw that with wine grapes when they were attacked by the phylloxera. because phylloxera was indigenous to the Americas, and it destroyed the French wine crop. They wound up using American rootstocks to get
same
past that.
Same thing with the Irish potato famine. The potato is native. The center of origin of the potato is in Peru and Colombia in the Andes. And when they had to find a cure for the devastating potato famine, they went there and found
We wind up, if you go to the farmer's market, you find about 50 different varieties of potatoes, purple ones and orange ones.
That's
and
a very, very recent innovation.
Could we do that with wheat? Because Skovmand became somewhat famous in 1979 for his work with a new breed of wheat called triticale.
Triticale.
And why was that such an important project?
You know why? It was really Borlaug. Skovmand was a disciple of Borlaug. He was one of Borlaug's heirs. And Borlaug was always looking for a grain that would work in the developing world. Triticale is a combination of rye and wheat. And it's been worked on for 100 years by scientists all over, because if you can take all the hardiness and cold resistance of rye and put it together with the delicacy and good flavor of wheat, you could have a grain that would grow in a very wide area.
Is Skovmand's work similar to the sort of thing that we have seen from Monsanto and other corporations that have gotten involved with genetic modification and selective plant breeding?
No. Skovmand was a real opponent of proprietary ownership of genetic components. He really believed in the free exchange of germplasm, and he did not believe in patents. He had to live with them because that was what the world had come to, but he was not in favor of patenting. He said patenting genes for crops is like patenting every word in Hamlet. Well, and charging you every time you use a word from Hamlet.
Well, when he started, most of the funding came from public sources, and it was in the 1980s that privatization kind of took over. Why did public funding dry up?
Public funding dried up as an act of will. In 1980, the United States Supreme Court said that private industry could own the bits of life that they invented and found. So you could own a gene, you could own a bacterium, you could own a microbe. That meant that there was tremendous profit to be made suddenly. And since there was tremendous profit to be made suddenly in the ownership of genes, huge amounts of money went into it, and the best scientists, not the best, but many of the best scientists were pulled over into private research. And the government said, listen, the private industry and private foundations are ready to do this job now. The World Bank pulled back. They pulled back, to, I think, by 2005, with 9%. In 1975, it was 30% was public funding.
Where did the idea of a single world seed bank come from?
Out of terror.
Because we did a show a while back on this incredible place where...
Svalbard, If you read Hans Christian Andersen, there's a story called The Snow Queen. Svalbard is where the Snow Queen lives. It's up at the top of the world on the border of Norway and the Arctic. It's the coldest place.
Is that a reason for putting it there?
Yes. The Argentines had considered the idea of putting seeds into a freezer, an international freezer, was around for a while. The Argentines thought of putting it down at the bottom of the country and near the Antarctic, and the Peruvians thought of putting it up in the Andes.
And the idea is, if something happens and we need to go back and find older varieties of wheat or any other
to restore
kind of grain,
agriculture, exactly,
we could go there. How much is stored of each variety?
Every country has got now, I think, almost every country in the world, with the help of the Gates Foundation, has got stored seeds of its crops there. Ours, we have everything there.
Including genetically modified varieties?
Nope.
So these all have to be
in the kinds of varieties that are in the public domain. Yes, that are in the public domain, that are not privately owned. It's not that they grow naturally. It's that they're not owned by anybody.
Has anybody ever had to go and take something out of the bank?
So far, no. So far, no. Let's hope it stays that way.
And what happened in Uganda with the
with the UG 99? An extraordinary thing. Norman Borlaug, at the end of his life, became very active in trying to fight UG 99. And the United States government had withdrawn all of its funding from the international wheat collections in Mexico and the one in Syria. And he was sick and very old at the time. And he got himself down to Washington and he lobbied like crazy, got the money restored. And an enormous collection, I think it was scientists from 40 countries, many of whom don't speak to each other, collected themselves into a consortium in Mexico. And they have done everything in their power to find resistance cooperatively to UG99. And they've come up with some strains of wheat which are able to resist this. Now they have to breed it into the local variety.
Has UG99 popped up in other places?
It's gotten to Iran, and the last I heard, they think it's in India.
Hmm.
So it's moving. It's moving. It depends on the trade winds, and it depends on how quickly the resistant varieties can be multiplied and seed can be sent to China and Pakistan and Afghanistan and the countries that are in danger. We have, in our country, a very, very highly developed plan, which was created by the Agricultural Research Service, to guard this country in case UG99 breaks out. There's only one lab in the country that gets to even touch it. That's at the University of Minnesota in the dead of winter, in the freezing cold.
Because cold keeps it under control?
Because there's no wheat growing in Minnesota in the dead of winter, and nothing can get out.
Susan Dworkin's book, The Viking in the Wheat Field, A Scientist's Struggle to Preserve the World's Harvest, is published by Walker & Company. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.